From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. The band Steely Dan had a string of hits in the 70s, sung by the band's co-founder, Donald Fagen. Fagen's been largely out of sight since the early 80s, but he's recently resurfaced with his New York Rock and Soul Review. We talk with Fagen on this edition of Fresh Air. Also today, we talk with Ambassador Max Kampelman about heading American delegations at nuclear arms talks and human rights conventions. And jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews a new reissue from singer Julie London. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. While describing the Soviet situation as a very rapid, radical transition, U.S. officials are looking on the bright side, pointing to the commitment by the three Slavic republics to respect borders, human rights, and international agreements, including arms control pacts. NPR's Anne Garrels reports.
Russian President Boris Yeltsin has assured President Bush Soviet nuclear arms are safe, though not all Soviet nuclear weapons are limited to the three Commonwealth republics. There are strategic weapons in Kazakhstan and tactical nuclear weapons in all the republics. But for now, the administration appears to be satisfied all these weapons remain under a unified command. Concerned about future security, U.S. officials are pressing the republics to fulfill agreements and pledges to eliminate thousands of these weapons. A senior Pentagon official worried today the republics may be tempted into an intramural arms race. But even harder to control than weapons is the talent that goes into making them. Secretary of State Baker will raise all these concerns when he visits the Commonwealth republics starting this weekend. I'm Ann Garrels in Washington.
The Iraqi envoy in Washington was summoned to the State Department today to receive an official protest of the way Saddam Hussein's government is treating Kurdish civilians. Spokeswoman Margaret Tutwiler said that the protest accused Iraq of military attacks that have driven as many as 200,000 Kurdish civilians from their homes. She said that Saddam's government has also imposed an economic embargo on the Kurds. In South Africa, 22 people were killed in township violence over the weekend. Six died in the province of Natal. They were followers of the African National Congress, who've been battling the Zulu-based Inkatha Freedom Party. 17 others were killed following an Inkatha rally in the township of Soweto. It was the worst violence in months and comes as most of the country's political parties prepare for constitutional talks. From Johannesburg, NPR's Renee Montaigne has more.
It was perhaps to be expected that serious violence would break out. A rash of killings has preceded virtually every other major step toward reform here. Witnesses say the trouble in Soweto began when some 12,000 heavily armed Inkatha supporters headed home to the workers' hostels after their rally. Nine people were killed when a group of gun-wielding men rushed into a house near one of those hostels. During the rally, Inkatha Freedom Party leader Mangosuthu Buthelezi threatened to boycott the upcoming constitutional negotiations unless his homeland of KwaZulu was allowed three separate delegations, Inkatha already invited, plus representatives of both the homeland itself and the Zulu King. But though he said he personally might stay away from the talks, Buthelezi nonetheless gave them his full endorsement. In Johannesburg, I'm Renee Montaigne.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 15 points today to finish the day at 2,871.64. This is NPR News. A consumer research group released a study today charging that the government's worker safety watchdog agency is weak and ineffective. The study, conducted by a group called Essential Information, found that the Occupational Safety and Health Administration only imposed fines for about a third of safety citations issued against major companies. The study looked at citations issued to the nation's 50 largest corporations over the past 14 years. A spokesman for the group said that work safety violators have no incentive to improve conditions because OSHA rarely issues fines. An OSHA spokesman said his agency hasn't seen the report yet and declined to comment. Another large American city became a one-newspaper town today. Robert Wood of member station KERA reports.
Today, collectors are snapping up the remaining copies of the Dallas Times-Herald. After 112 years of circulation, the Pulitzer Prize-winning paper has printed its last edition. It's been sold for $55 million to A.H. Below Corporation, publishers of the Times-Herald's rival, the Dallas Morning News. Times-Herald officials cite dwindling circulation and a struggling regional economy for the paper's downfall. Meanwhile, the sale gives A.H. Below an even stronger voice in Dallas. In addition to the Morning News, the company owns one of the city's largest television stations. Starting tomorrow, Dallas will be the largest city in the nation to have only one local newspaper. For National Public Radio, this is Robert Wood in Dallas.
There was a memorial scheduled today in Florida for Kimberly Bergalis, the 23-year-old woman whose AIDS infection was traced to her dentist. Bergalis died of the disease yesterday. Another former patient of the same dentist has vowed to continue Bergalis' fight for legislation imposing mandatory AIDS testing for healthcare workers. So far, five patients of the late Dr. David Acer have been found to be infected with the AIDS virus. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest Donald Fagen was the co-founder of one of the more successful pop groups of the 70s, Steely Dan. Fagen was the pianist and lead singer. He co-wrote the songs with his partner, guitarist Walter Becker. Steely Dan's hits included Ricky Don't Lose That Number, Reelin' in the Years, Peg, and FM. The band rarely toured, and Fagen and Becker seldom gave interviews. They went their separate ways in 1981. Since then, Fagen has made one solo album and has written some film music. Now he has a new album called The New York Rock and Soul Review, Live at the Beacon. The record features performers like Michael McDonald, Phoebe Snow, and Boz Scaggs doing their versions of rock and soul classics like Knock on Wood and Lonely Teardrops. Fagen and McDonald perform the Steely Dan tune, Pretzel Logic. Get the idea for the New York Rock and Soul Review?
Well, a friend of mine, Libby Titus, was producing some club concerts and shows in restaurants around Manhattan, and she asked me if I'd like to do a couple of those small concerts. So I hadn't been getting much of an opportunity to play, so I did a few of those things, and that finally expanded into a more miscellaneous sort of soul show. And then finally we mixed in some contemporary stuff and got some big stars and ended up doing a show at the Beacon Theater in 1990 and then repeated it in 1991 with a slightly different cast. And that's the shows that were recorded.
You said you hadn't been getting many opportunities to play. Had you wanted more opportunities to play?
I spent most of the 80s not really performing, and I guess I'd spent so many years in the studio, I felt like I wanted to get out and play some. And this was, you know, a good opportunity to do it in a kind of low-pressure situation.
What made you want to get out and perform as opposed to being in the studio?
Well, Nightfly record, which was my solo record, came out in 1980 or 81, and I kind of went into a writer's block for the first half of the 80s, and I was looking for alternative things to do until I was, you know, felt I was inspired to write. So I took some other jobs, doing some music for movies and some production work, and I also did some writing actually for Premiere Magazine. I was doing a film music column, I guess what I'd rather have been doing was playing. So when the opportunity came along, I took it.
One of the performers on the new record is formerly of the Young Rascals,
mm-hmm.
and he does Groovin'.
Right.
Old friend of yours? Or were you an old fan of the Rascals?
Yeah, I'm a big Rascals fan. I think New Yorkers are very attached to the Rascals. As I've said before, I think that if there was ever a New York local band that typified New York, I think it was the Rascals. They had a kind of very up soul sound that was very original with them, they were real authentic white soul singers, and they had a string of hits in the 60s, which are still very popular around town here, and people loved the Rascals. They were a fantastic live band in their time that were known far and wide as being the most exciting band you could possibly see in a club. And so when we were putting this together, we wanted to get as many Rascals as we could. We only ended up with Eddie and his brother, but maybe someday we'll get some more Rascals as well.
Donald Fagen is my guest. Since on your new record you pay homage to songs and performers who you like a lot, I'm interested in your musical biography. What kind of music did you grow up listening to growing up in, I think it was Passaic, New Jersey?
Let's see. My mother was a dance band singer from the age of 5 till, I guess, about 17. She used to sing in the Catskills.
You were 5. She wasn't 5, right? Yeah.
She was 5, right. Yeah. Yeah, no, she was. She started at 5 years old. And doing shows up in the Catskills, she was kind of a local Borscht Belt child star, and she worked every summer until she was 17. So she knew, you know, every possible standard, and she had a very nice kind of back phrasing, swing type phrasing style, and she used to sing around the house, you know, during my childhood. So. I knew all the basic standards. And then when I was about 8 or 9 years old, quite young, I had some older cousins who turned me on to jazz. And I was kind of a weenie jazz fan. I collected jazz and became, you know, very, very involved with not only the music, but the cultural realities of jazz and how it differed from my middle class background. I think like a lot of white middle-class kids, black music was, and its culture was an alternative. I think like a lot of kids, I found something missing in the American childhood, and jazz was, in a way, saved me.
So how old were you when you were able to go into the city to jazz clubs?
Well, my cousins who were in high school used to take me in to the city when I was 10 or 11 years old. I remember sitting in the kiddie section of the Vanguard.
They had a kiddie section?
Well, they said we'll put you in the kiddie section. What it actually was the banquettes along the wall right next to the where they used to have the drum kit. And I remember at 11 years old sitting right next to Danny Richmond, who was playing with Charlie Mingus, and having my glass of Coca-Cola vibrate towards the edge of the table from the power of his drumming, and have to keep moving my glass back towards the middle of the table.
So how did you discover or rediscover rock and soul and rhythm and blues?
Well, I think in the mid-60s, 65, which is the year I went to college up at Bard College in Annandale, New York. Jazz had changed quite a bit, or was in the process of changing into a more, really a more political music because of what was going on in the country culturally as far as black and white. And at the same time, I felt that I couldn't relate to the music as well as I had done. And at the same time, I discovered blues and soul music, which had, I think, had also had a lot of the political feeling and, in fact, political relevance about them. But I could relate to it more easily. And it had a kind of directness, which I was looking for at that time. And, you know, it was unfamiliar music to me. But it had a lot of the kind of soul that I had always heard in jazz, and it just attracted me. And I also liked a lot of the you know, white rock bands that were around at the time.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Donald Fagen, formerly of Steely Dan, and he has a new record called the New York Rock and Soul Review. We're going to take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Donald Fagen. In the 1970s, he and Walter Becker formed the band Steely Dan. Here's the song Dr. Wu from their album Katie Lied.
Katie tried. I was halfway crucified. I was on the other side of no tomorrow. You walked in and my life began again. Just when I'd spent the last piaster I could borrow. All night long, we would sing that stupid song. And every word we sang, I knew was true. Are you with me, Dr. Wu? Are you real?
You and Walter Becker met when you were both in college.
Mm-hmm.
You started to play together then?
Yeah, I had a band at that time. I guess it was about 66, 67, and Walter was came in a couple of years after I did, and I heard him practicing the guitar one day, and I asked him to join the band.
The band that you and Walter Becker formed in college was not called Steely Dan, was it?
No, we had, you know, a million different, you know, bad names.
Oh, let's hear some.
I'm trying to think back. I think, you know, one time we were toying with the Leather Canary.
You know, what does that mean?
I'm not sure, but those were the years, you know, that
right.
That you know, odd metaphors and seemed to be the thing to do. And that band didn't work out, but we did continue writing songs together. And after college, we continued to work together.
Whose idea was naming the band Steely Dan? Had you read a lot of William Burroughs fiction?
Yeah, Walter and I were both Burroughs fans, and we needed a name in a hurry, and this was about 1971. We'd already started recording an album, and we thought that this was kind of a funny in-joke to call it Steely Dan, which is a sexual device, which is mentioned in kind of cartoon sexual device, which is mentioned in Naked Lunch by William Burroughs. And, of course, we thought that this band would last about 6 months and that we'd, you know, then go on to something else. I think probably if we had thought about it, we would have come up with something more original.
Well, did you ever feel, once everybody found out what Steely Dan meant, did you ever feel stuck with a name that you didn't want anymore?
In a way, but, you know, it kind of, by that time, it sort of meant something else, so...
Right, it meant the band.
Yeah, so, you know, apologies to William Burroughs.
Now, before you and Walter Becker formed Steely Dan, you were part of the backup group for Jay and the Americans, whose hits included Only in America, She Cried, Come a Little Bit Closer, Cara Mia. Now, you toured with them in 70 and 71. They had their last record on the chart in 1970, so this was the decline period for Jay and the Americans. I mean, let's face it, you know, psychedelic music was in, Jay and the Americans was out at that time. So what was it like to tour with a band that had had a lot of hits but was on the way down?
Yeah, they were on a declining curve, no doubt. And but for us, it was great because it was a job playing music with a professional group, and it was our really I think that was our earliest experience of doing real touring, and we got a lot of experience as you know, with how to keep a rhythm section tight, how to play together, and. We had a lot of fun in that group because we didn't have any responsibility. There were four guys in monkey suits standing in front of us, and it made it very very easy and fun.
Did you like the band's music?
Well, you know, it wasn't really our cup of tea, but you know, if you play music, any kind of music, if it has a good groove, it's fun to play. It really doesn't matter what it is.
You went out to Los Angeles with Walter Becker to become staff writers for ABC Records.
Right.
Describe what the job was like as a staff writer.
Staff writing was a great job. We were probably among the very last staff writers ever hired by a record company, which was definitely the idea of having staff writers was on its way out. But we had a little room with a piano in it, and every day we'd come in at 9 o'clock. To the our little studio and try to write pop songs for the artists on the label, and it was fun. Unfortunately, Walter and I are probably among the worst pop song writers ever. our songs tended to be imitative of other pop songs, and you know, we were basically writing on order for groups like the Grassroots, for. There was a few other groups we tried to write for who were on the label, like it's Three Dog Night, but none of them ever actually recorded any of our songs. I think Denny Daugherty, formerly with the Mamas and Papas, did one, but I don't think it was ever released.
Were you writing lyrics as cryptic for the Grassroots as you later wrote for your own group?
Well, we tried to, you know, that was another problem. We tried to write lyrics that, you know, were less personal and you know, more universal and more romantic, but generally that was another element that was made them sort of easy to resist by the by the commercial pop singers.
Do you remember any lyrics that you could tell?
Well,
us?
You know, I remember trying to interest some of the you know. Mainstream pop groups during a song called Proud to Be Your Slave.
How did that go?
I remember it had a kind of Carole King type of feeling about it, but you know, it was the lyrics just got more and more perverse as they went on, and we just couldn't help ourselves. So we realized we had to get a band together if we were going to actually do any recording.
So did Proud to Be Your Slave, did that help lead to Steely Dan?
You know, we had our own book of songs that were more personal and had, I think, expressed a kind of our sense of humor and our sort of attitude. And these songs were songs that we would never try to pawn off on anyone else. It was things that we knew we had to do with our own group. And it was this book of songs that we basically used for the Steely Dan group.
Why did Steely Dan become more of a studio band than a touring band, especially given that you and Walter Becker had, you know, gotten your start playing as the backup band for Jay and the Americans? So you had experience being on the road, playing very different music, but being on the road.
Mm-hmm. Well, the band was put together very quickly, the same way the title, the name of the band was chosen. We basically started recording with a five-man group that were recruited from mostly from studio players that we had played with in the East Coast. And we, for years, we'd been looking for a singer that could be a front man and, you know, who had a what we at the time thought of as a true singing voice. And we'd never been able to find one. At the last moment, we brought in a guy named Dave Palmer, who one of the other guys knew. And we started recording the record with him singing. But everyone seemed to agree that the attitude we were trying to express was really lost. It was something very personal. So I was elected as being able to, you know, sing the most in tune. And I mean, between Walter and I, my pitch was a little better, and I had the right attitude. So I became the front man. And in fact, professional record I ever recorded was "Do It Again," which became a big hit.
You think of the singer as being the front man?
Well, certainly on stage, there was no one else willing to do it, really. So by default, I became the singer and the front man.
Were you uncomfortable with this new position?
Well, yes and no. I didn't like the pressure. You know, I had an untrained voice, and my voice would get tired by the end of a night of singing for like an hour and a half and in front of a big, noisy rock and roll band. And, you know, I enjoyed performing, and I enjoyed playing, but the singing and the and especially talking to the audience was new to me, and it was difficult for me. I'm basically was a shy kid, and it was a little hard going for me.
For you, it must have been hard when the band broke up because you were used to writing songs in a collaborative relationship, you know, in partnership with with Walter Becker.
You mean when Walter and I split up?
Yeah.
Well, that was later on in about 80. And, it was very difficult for both of us. But I think we had both agreed that we had run out of some kind of energy by that time, and we just needed a vacation from each other.
How did that work out for you? Did that coincide with your period of writer's block breaking up?
Well, I had this album I wanted to do, which is basically autobiographical, and I knew I'd have to do that myself, and that turned into The Nightfly.
Mm-hmm.
And then I think it was after The Nightfly when I felt that I needed to take some time, and I would work every day, but I just didn't like what I was writing, and it seemed either repetitive. Or I would write something one day, and then 2 days later, I'd play it back and just didn't like the way it sounded. And I think it had to do with my life. And, you know, I was in my 30s by then, and I think I just needed to do some self-analysis and sit out a few years and do some other things to sort of get back some kind of creative energy.
Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Nice talking to you.
Donald Fagen is working on a new album of his own songs. He co-wrote some with Walter Becker, who's also producing the album. Here's Donald Fagen singing Green Flower Street from his new album, The New York Rock and Soul Review.
Uptown, it's mud out in the street. Uptown.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, some reflections on negotiating with the Soviets during the Cold War. Ambassador Max Kempelman looks back on his work heading up American delegations to nuclear arms talks and human rights conventions. In the 1950s and 60s, singer Julie London was known for her sultry performances. There's a new Julie London reissue. Our jazz critic Kevin Whitehead gives it a listen. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. Soviet leader Gorbachev has challenged a declaration by Russia, Ukraine, and Belarus of the formation of a new commonwealth of independent states and the end of the Soviet Union. In a statement read on Soviet television tonight, Gorbachev said that only the national parliament and not the three various Soviet republics has the right to decide the nation's future. NPR's Mike Schuster reports from Moscow.
The leaders of the three republics, among them Russia's Boris Yeltsin, declared yesterday that the Soviet Union had ceased to exist. Today, after meeting with Yeltsin, Gorbachev issued his own statement, labeling that illegal and dangerous, an encouragement to chaos and anarchy. Gorbachev claimed that the three leaders were not empowered to make a decision on the fate of the entire Soviet Union on their own. As for the Commonwealth of Independent States, which the three current and former republics of the Soviet Union created yesterday, Gorbachev said it was not formed constitutionally and suggested all the republics should have a say. So far, only Armenia, according to Soviet television, has signaled its interest in joining the Commonwealth. The remaining republics are staying uncommitted for now. I'm Mike Schuster in Moscow.
The state of Pennsylvania has appealed to the U.S. Supreme Court, asking the High Court to reconsider the landmark Roe v. Wade abortion ruling. The state's decision to act 6 weeks before a legal deadline will speed up consideration of the matter and means that the nation's high court could overrule Roe v. Wade this term, just 4 months before the presidential election next fall. NPR's Nina Totenberg reports.
When the Supreme Court, in effect, legalized abortion in 1973, it did so by a 7-2 vote. But with the appointment by Presidents Reagan and Bush of five new justices, the court has edged closer and closer to reversing Roe. Last month, in a case from Pennsylvania, a coalition of pro-choice groups asked the court outright to declare whether Roe v. Wade is still the law of the land. The state of Pennsylvania was allowed 90 days to respond. But today, the Pennsylvania Attorney General acted 6 weeks early and joined the pro-choice groups in asking the nation's highest court to declare itself on Roe. State Attorney General Ernie Priate said he was filing papers in the case early so that the court can hear and decide the case this term. The state of Pennsylvania is asking the high court to uphold the state law restricting the availability of abortion. I'm Nina Totenberg in Washington.
In Chicago, officials say at least 10 people were killed this morning when fire hit an apartment building. A fire official said the victims included five children under the age of 9. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down nearly 15 points to close at 2,871.65 in active trading. This is NPR News. Middle Eastern peace talks are scheduled to get underway tomorrow morning in Washington, nearly 1 week behind the date originally set by U.S. officials. However, there is still disagreement over several procedural matters. Arab delegations have been in Washington for over a week now, but Israeli diplomats arrived only yesterday after saying that they needed more time for preparation. Both sides have informed the State Department that they plan to attend tomorrow morning's meeting. The talks are to be held on three different floors at the State Department, and each delegation will arrive at a different entrance. In New York City, the UN General Assembly has strongly endorsed a measure calling for a registry of conventional arms. The vote was 150-0 in favor of the move. NPR's Jim Zaroli has more on the story.
The purpose of the registry, which was first proposed by Britain, is to make global arms trafficking more transparent. Starting in 1993, countries are supposed to provide data each time they buy or sell weapons, including tanks, armored vehicles, combat aircraft, attack helicopters, warships, and missiles. They also are to provide background information on their existing supplies of imported or domestically produced weapons. Both the U.S. and the Soviet Union were among the co-sponsors of the measure. Some non-aligned countries complained that the registry is selective because it will not include data about the transfer of military technology by industrialized countries. But UN officials said the registry could be expanded later to include other kinds of transactions. In New York, this is Jim Zaroli reporting.
U.S. West says that it will cut some 6,000 jobs starting next year and covering the next 3 years. The company also says that it will take a one-time after-tax charge in the fourth quarter, coming to some $590 million. $150 million of this will be to cover the workforce reduction. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. The current round of Mideast peace talks is a reminder of what a fine art negotiating is. My guest Max Kampelman is one of our country's artful diplomatic ambassadors, having served both Democratic and Republican administrations. He headed the U.S. delegation to the Conference on Security and Cooperation in Europe, which met in Madrid and focused largely on human rights issues in the Soviet Union, and the delegation to negotiations on nuclear and space arms, which met in Geneva. Just a few months ago, Kampelman headed a human rights delegation at a month-long conference in Moscow. Kampelman's route to the negotiating table was different from many of his colleagues. He grew up in the Bronx. As a young man, he was both liberal and anti-communist. He was a conscientious objector during World War II on moral and religious grounds. But he felt the rules of war changed with the atom bomb, and being a CO no longer seemed effective to him. He joined the Marines. I asked him if, after his years of Cold War negotiations, he was prepared for the collapse of the Soviet Union.
I had no doubt in my mind but that the Soviet system was rather rotten to the core. Now, you don't expect something that's rotten to the core to last, but I think it's also true that I did not expect that the changes would take place peacefully and without violence. That was totally unexpected and obviously most welcome as far as I was concerned. I mean, the fact that the Warsaw Pact, for example, could disintegrate without violence, that the Communist Party would give up its power or would be forced to give up its power without violence and bloodshed, all of those things were unexpected and highly welcome.
You write in your book that negotiating is more an art than a science. Can you tell me what you thought the sneakiest thing was that ever happened during negotiations that you participated in?
Well, I don't know that I can think of the sneakiest thing. I tend in life to look at the more positive things. But obviously, when you're negotiating and you don't like what the other side does, you look upon it as somewhat sneaky. I remember when I started the arms talks. And this comes to mind now to answer your question. The day before the arms talks in Geneva were to start in 1985, Mr. Chernenko died, the leader of the Soviet Union. So I called up my Soviet counterpart, whom I'd never met, but I knew he spoke some English. And I said, look, Mr. Ambassador, I see where Chernenko has died. We're supposed to meet tomorrow and open up our session. As far as we're concerned, if you want to have this tomorrow as a day of mourning and postpone the opening for a day, we'll accommodate. If you have to go back to Moscow for the funeral and want to postpone the talks a few days, we'll accommodate ourselves. He said, no, no, by no means do you have to worry about that. We'll continue as planned. I said, fine. But what I will do, as a matter of courtesy, is I'll stop by your embassy and sign the memorial book, which is a diplomatic nicety, which I knew about and offered to do. He said, I'd appreciate that very much. Well, I did that the next day, and that meant that I was about 5 minutes late coming into the meeting hall because I was delayed in the memorial book ceremony. And there I walk in, and I find my Soviet colleague taking advantage of my 5 minutes being late in order to have a unilateral press conference and try to get some kind of an advantage. Well, I thought that was rather sneaky. And I told him so. And I told him he shouldn't have done it, and I don't want him to do it again. And I think he took me seriously, and he didn't do it again.
What was the effect of the press conference?
Actually, I was able to negate the effect of the press conference by simply saying we're going to delay going into our talk. And I then began talking to the press, and I gave him our objectives and what our intentions were. So that, in effect, the press ended up with a balanced rather than an unbalanced story.
What is the breakthrough that you helped with during negotiations that you participated in that you're proudest of?
Well, there are really two areas. The first was the implicit recognition by the Soviets after a really long, long period of negotiation that their human rights behavior and our human rights behavior were matters of international concern and not necessarily matters only of their internal responsibility or our internal responsibility. Now, in another area, which is somewhat related, is in the arms control. When I started negotiating in arms control, a number of people came to me and expressed surprise that I would have assumed that responsibility. And when I inquired why they expressed surprise, they said, because you'll never get an agreement. You know the United States cannot accept an agreement based on trusting the Soviets. We're going to need to be able to verify the agreements that the Soviets sign. And you know we can't accept verification unless we can have people on the scene looking through their own eyes as to whether the agreement is being enforced or not. And the Soviets will never permit that, because the Soviets have made it clear that's an interference in their internal affairs. Well, one of the great things I'm proud of was that in our negotiations in Geneva, the Soviets finally agreed to have on-site inspection, namely that we could have inspectors in Soviet military establishments and factories, just as they could have inspectors in ours. That broke the back of the whole arms control impasse, because it meant no longer do we have to base our agreement on trusting the other side, but we could verify.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Ambassador Max Kampelman, and he's headed up American delegations on human rights and nuclear arms reductions. He's written a memoir called Entering New Worlds, the memoirs of a private man in public life. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. Ambassador Max Kampelman is my guest. You grew up Jewish in the Bronx, and as you say in your memoir, that growing up Jewish in the Bronx is a little bit like growing up German in Berlin. You're from the same background as everybody around you is. That wasn't the case, I don't think, for you in government. As an ambassador, as an American ambassador, did you ever feel set apart because of being Jewish?
No, I really didn't. But a few incidents come to mind now that are significant, perhaps. When I started my diplomatic activity as an ambassador, it was in Madrid with the Soviets. And just before our meeting opened, through an intermediary, I spent a few hours with the Soviet delegate. And we went through a lot. We spent about at least three hours together. Maybe it was a little longer than that. We had a good talk. You got to remember, this was at a time of Afghanistan, And our talking with each other was the only time during that period that the U.S. was talking officially to the Soviet Union. And we were very honest. I was very straight and direct with him. And that night, after our meeting, my aide, who spoke Russian well, called me on the telephone and said, look, he just heard from the Soviets. They wanted to meet the next night again to continue our conversation. And I made an instantaneous decision. And I said, look, you call him back and you say, I'm sorry, but tomorrow night is the Jewish high holidays. And I'm going to the synagogue tomorrow night. And I'll be glad to meet with him the following evening. I just wanted to make that point. Well, the point, I'm sure he knew I was Jewish, but I also wanted to make it perfectly clear that not only was I Jewish, but I talked about it. And I wanted him to know that. I think that had an impact on him. But I can never honestly say to you that I ever felt any discrimination or being set apart by the fact that I was Jewish in the United States government.
One of the parts of your memoir that I found very interesting had to do with the difficulty of maintaining your health when you're a diplomat at high-level negotiations. You had a heart attack in 1987.
I did.
And shortly before that, you were in Geneva, heading up an American delegation. And, you know, you say it was just very hard to keep healthy. You're used to working on a treadmill at home for exercise. That didn't work out in Geneva.
That's true.
And
the dietary standards are different in Europe. And it was, you know, I used to say in Geneva that it's very difficult to find a restaurant that did not have superb food. And that food is generally, you know, French food. And French food is a food filled with creams. So those of us who have some kind of a concentrated attention to cholesterol find ourselves at a disadvantage.
Well, what about at diplomatic meals? I imagine there are certain meals that you are served that are very high cholesterol that would be really impolite to not eat.
That was the point. And that turned out to be a handicap. Plus the following fact. I guess I never had a job as difficult or as stressful as the arms negotiating job that I had in Geneva. It was a highly visible job. You may remember that I was in the newspapers, my photograph was in the newspapers, and not just in the United States, but even more so in Europe. And I had the experience many times, believe me, of walking on a street or being at an airport and having somebody coming over and saying, you know, my blessings are with you, or my children or grandchildren's life depends on what you do. You know, exaggerated kind of concerns, but obviously to the people expressing it, not exaggerated. Exaggerated, I suppose, in my own mind, but only because I never feel that any one person is indispensable toward a process. But let me tell you, I found that to be very stressful. I found that to fill me with a sense of duty and a sense of responsibility, and a sense which in effect said, you've got to do everything you can to succeed here. There's a lot at stake. And the combination of stress plus lack of exercise, I mean, the security forces didn't want me to walk in Geneva. They wanted me to go in a bulletproof car because Geneva is an open city with a lot of PLO people and terrorists, and so they wanted me in a bulletproof car. So a lack of exercise, food that's in itself rich, plus stress, all of that, I think, must have contributed to the heart attack. So I had the heart attack, and I suppose I'm lucky to be alive, but I'm very happy to be alive. And well, I'm glad we finished the task.
You were just in Moscow in the fall for a human rights convention. Did you think when you were offered the chance to head up the American delegation in Moscow? Did you think of saying no for health reasons? Or do you feel like you've often had to decide between, you know, personal health and a larger calling?
Well, let me say that right after my heart attack, when I was in the hospital for nearly, well, more than 10 days, and then I was home recuperating, and then there was a meeting going to be taking place in Geneva. I had my arms negotiations, and it was a rather important meeting coming up. And I asked my doctor, I told him I wanted to go to Geneva, and he permitted me. So actually, shortly thereafter, I went. Now, my wife insisted that one of my children accompany me, so I shouldn't be alone. And so he should watch over me a little bit and keep me from being excessive in my energy. And he did, and it worked out very well. No, I never thought of saying no because of my health to the Moscow meeting or the Geneva meeting or the Copenhagen meeting of the last 2 years. I'm pleased to serve, and though I am a little tired now of traveling given my age, the fact of the matter is when you're given an opportunity to serve, I just feel I ought to serve.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us about your life and your career. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much for your interest.
Ambassador Max Kampelman, his new memoir is called Entering New Worlds. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Linda Wertheimer's with us. Linda, what do you have on the new Commonwealth of former Soviet republics?
Terry, we have Mike Schuster on the case, and he is covering what the new Commonwealth is going to mean to the old president of the old Soviet Union, Mikhail Gorbachev. We also are covering the mayor's race in San Francisco, which is turning into a serious debate on urban decay. And we're going to visit Oklahoma, Ada, Oklahoma, a small town in the south central part of the state, to talk about the economy, about the recession, what people think is happening now, what it may mean for their town, and what they think their future and the future of their children will be like.
Thanks, Linda. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead has a review of a reissue of music from the 50s and 60s by singer Julie London. London may be best remembered now for her sexy image, appearing in pin-up poses on the covers of albums with titles like Calendar Girl, Make Love to Me, and Nice Girls Don't Stay for Breakfast. Kevin says the way London was packaged has caused some listeners to underestimate her musical smarts.
Gone with the wind, gone like a leaf that has blown away, gone with the wind, my romance has flown away.
Los Angeles in the 1950s is infamous for producing some very low-key music, the cool, sun-bleached sounds known as West Coast jazz. But even by California standards, when it came to laid-back singing, Julie London could beat out everybody except maybe Perry Como.
I'm in the mood for love, simply because you're near me.
Julie London came out of the L.A. film community. She'd appeared in a few movies in the 1940s before dropping out to raise a family. There was always something really filmic about her singing persona. She deliberately played on the Hollywood stereotype of the dangerous blonde who was icy outside and steamy inside. In the mid-50s, London was rediscovered as a singer by songwriter Bobby Troup. He helped her develop her sound and later became her second husband. London began working in a club with two pieces, the smallest number of players that could pass for a band. She used the same lineup on her first album and on her one big hit. The stark sound of guitar, bass, and voice was the audio equivalent of the great film noir visual effect, a spotlight casting the shadow of a Venetian blind onto a dark wall.
Now you say you're lonely. You cry the long night through. Well, you can cry me a river. Cry me a river. I cried a river over you. Now,
Cry Me a River is one of 18 tunes on a CD from the Rhino label called A Time for Love, The Best of Julie London. Because her deadpan delivery was so perfect, she could put over racy material a more excitable singer might not have gotten away with.
Go slow, ooh, ooh, honey. We've got such a lot of time. When love is slow, ooh, honey, how the mercury does climb. I like my loving done gently. So when your kissing lips start, just a little here, a little there, sort of a la carte.
That last bit includes what may be the most lewd use of strings in music history. Like a good film noir heroine, Julie London had a sense of humor about her sex pod image. This is from Bobby Troup's composition, Daddy, as in Sugar Daddy.
Hey, Daddy. I want a diamond ring, bracelets, everything. Daddy, you ought to get the best for me. Daddy G. Won't I look swell in sables, clothes with Paris labels? Daddy, you ought to get the best for me. Here's an amazing revelation with a bit of stimulation. I'd be a great sensation. I'd be your inspiration, Daddy.
The last recording on the new Julie London collection dates from 1965. After that, she retreated from singing, though in the 70s, she and Bobby Troup co-starred on the TV show Emergency, produced by her ex-husband, Jack Webb. In her prime, London so embodied Hollywood ideals of womanhood, ideals which are now outmoded, you might not think her stuff would hold up. But it's as unexpectedly timeless as a low-budget film noir or a Jack Webb TV show. I mean, how can you not like this stuff?
Kevin Whitehead is a freelance writer based in New York. He reviewed Time for Love, The Best of Julie London, on Rhino Records. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Amy Sallet, with Roberta Sherrock, Joan Tuohy, and Sue Weinstein. Research assistance from Ellen Silva. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by this and other NPR member stations. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
The pay of the average American worker has dropped in the past 20 years, while the pay of the average CEO at a major corporation has risen astronomically. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Grafe Crystal about the overcompensation of American executives. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.